Hi, and welcome back to Uncited, the internet's least reliable English lit podcast. I'm Chantel.
And I'm Amy.
And today, we're going back. We're going back to Chinua Achebe.
Back to Nigeria.
Back to the African trilogy. Hit us with it, Amy.
We're going back to Africa, and we're going to discuss the final novel in Chinua Achebe's masterful African trilogy.
And the books apparently tie together a little bit, but if you want a little bit of background on Chinua Achebe and the trilogy and where we read this, you can go back to our previous episode if you haven't, where we talk about Things Fall Apart.
Yeah, so I read Arrow of God, which is the book that we're talking about today. I'm holding it up. You can't see it because this is an audio medium.
That looks ominous.
Yeah, it's The Arrow of God, Chantel. I read The Arrow of God by Chinua Achebe in my African literature course during my master's degree. That class was really fun. I have no notes from it. I don't know what happened to my notes from that class. They have since disappeared from every laptop I seem to own.
Goodness.
Which is really sad because it had some gems like Achebe is Beyonce in it, and it also had like a really cool inside joke for this book, and also all the background for this book that I needed for this episode, but I don't have it. And I think that's very funny. So I took this class with a professor named Pius Adesami. He is a Nigerian Canadian. I guess he was a Nigerian Canadian. He died on March 10th, 2019, when the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 crashed, the second MAX 8 crash that happened. So he was on that flight coming back from a conference and he passed away. So that happened. Then I went to his funeral and then I had a bit of an existential crisis. The funny part here that I think a lot of people who were in that class with me are also going to find funny is we never got our final grades back for the papers we wrote for him. So we have this running inside joke that Pius took our grades to the grave. And it seems like he might have also taken my notes.
Oh no.
Because I don't have them anymore. But Pius was like a really cool prof. We also had a lot of inside jokes about how I was his timekeeper for class because I would dictate when we would need breaks / how long they were gonna be. On many occasions, he was like, only 10 minutes, Amy Lee. And I was like, cool. I'm going to like insert coffee shop here. It's gonna take the time it takes. And then we would all leave and go to the insert coffee shop here and get coffee and come back. And like, he wouldn't even be there. And then I'd be like, I thought we agreed on 20 minutes, not 30. He was like, meh, YOLO. And I was like, okay. He was a delight of a human being. And he is very missed in the academic sphere. He had built the African studies discipline at the university I went to. And he was like, he was a big deal. Like, Pius was a big deal. And we all called him Pius, which is great. And there's this video on YouTube that we can link to in the show notes as well that talk about a story that Pius used to say pretty much in every single one of his classes. We didn't get it on the first night, but we got it when we started reading some of the books where it was kind of important. So he would come up to the front of the class and he would talk about this spirit called an Abiku, which is a Yoruban spirit. I believe that's how you would say that. That's kind of put into a child, right? So when you're born, if you are an Abiku, basically, you will die shortly. So they usually are children that die before reaching puberty. And they often like come back to like the same mothers, which is kind of torturous. Mm-hmm. It's also a really interesting way to like explain, you know, how a lot of people's children would die repeatedly, right?
Yeah.
So Pius would tell us this story about, you know, the Abiku child and how this woman was giving birth to like multiple Abiku children and they, you know, kept passing away. And the grandmother of these children took the next baby and marked the child so that the spirit would like leave it alone, basically. And marked the child with two crescents on each cheeks. And Pius had a very distinct face with two crescents on each cheek.
Whoa, yo.
So he would end his like story being like, I am the Abiku child. At his funeral, one of his dear friends told us that they had been on a call and Pius had been like, I think I'm gonna die soon. I'm definitely gonna die before I'm 50, but I think I'm gonna die soon. He had like this feeling and his friends was like, Pius, like you can't talk like that, right? And Pius was like, no, like, it's gonna happen at some point. It's gonna happen soon enough, I think. And he made it to 47.
Wow.
Yeah. He was such a jovial human being. And I didn't realize how hard going back into this book and going back into anything that he's really, like, taught us would be. And normally when I cover a book, I go back through the book completely if I have it at home. And I go through my notes and I make my own notes and I, you know, kind of like I did for Consolation. I went through the entire book again. I basically speed read it. And I was gonna do this with this book and I started doing it and then I burst into tears. So I didn't, and I would like to thank the internet for helping me cobble together a summary of this book.
Thanks, internet.
Yikes. Also, ChatGPT for explaining to me the various parts of the novel that I clearly remembered but didn't have the context for anymore because I lost my notes. It's fine.
I just want to say that the Yoruba word for a bhikkhu child has an Igbo equivalent that we talked about last week, which is Ogbonji child.
Yes.
I don't know. I think there's a lot of stuff that we don't understand. I think it's very self-centered of us to just assume that we understand everything about how the world works.
Yeah. I think, you know, the universe has a way of doing things and we all have our own interpretations of how that works and what it means. And I think that what makes humans cool, frankly.
Yeah, I agree.
So we have an expression in French, ça prend toutes sortes de monde pour faire un monde, which roughly
takes all kinds of people to make up a world.
And I think it'd be boring if we were all the same. So I am dedicating this episode, I guess, to Pius, who would probably find it quite annoying at how I'm going to do this. And if you guys want, Carleton University has a whole page about him in memory of Dr. Pius Adesanya, and it has a lot of the very, very, very nice words that people have sent in about Pius, and I think that's beautiful.
That's lovely.
So, Arrow of God. It's also a yam story, which is fun.
We love a yam story, you know?
We love a good yam story.
You know who else loves a good yam story?
Is it vegan?
Chinua Achebe.
Okay. Not vegans. Well, maybe vegans. I don't know.
I'm a vegan and I like a good yam story. I haven't surveyed every vegan.
There's your problem, Chanteau. Survey all the vegans. Thanks.
All right. I am.
You're on it. I believe in you. Okay. So Arrow of God is a novel. It is the last one in the trilogy. We skip the middle one. Why? Because we can. It's our podcast. Clearly, we did not have a professor in either of our lives that wanted us to read the middle one. And if you have read the middle one and you want to come on the pod and talk about it, we'll gladly take a guest episode. Thank you.
Wait, let me see what it's called. Do you know what it's called?
I had it somewhere. Oh, No Longer at Ease.
Ain't that the frickin' truth, dude.
Arrow of God is a powerful drama about the downfall of a traditional leader in a society forever altered by colonialism.
Oh, wow. I think you're reading the wrong plot synopsis. That would be the plot of Things Fall Apart.
Ditto. Izulu is the main character here. He's a chief priest of several Nigerian villages, a prominent member of the Igbo people. So prominent, in fact, that he is invited to join the British colonial administration.
Oh.
But when he refuses to be a white man's chief and is thrown in jail, Izulu's influence begins to wane as the resentful decisions he makes from prison have adverse effect on his people. As Christian missionaries flood Izulu's villages, Western culture may very well unravel the traditions he has spent his life protecting. So, Arrow of God is set in the period between the pacification and independence of Nigeria.
Sorry, the pacification?
Yeah, I believe that's the Arrow of God part. No, the Things Fall Apart part.
Colonization?
No, they call it pacification here.
That's such a weird word for it.
Yeah.
It feels...
It's giving colonialism. Yes,
it's
I know.
It's giving bad. It's giving racism.
It's giving racism. It's not my fault. The internet has got me here. But let me see if pacification has like a proper term here. Oh, pacification of Nigeria. So the British forces began annual pacifications missions to convince the local of British supremacy. So it's like colonialism, but
it's like colonialism. And also being like, we just don't want you to complain about it. Can you just not, just don't do anything about it? Just let us, can you? Because we don't want to deal with people fighting back for their lands that they have had for thousands of years. Can you just like let us?
Yeah. So it's during the British period, if that makes you feel any grosser about it. So the novel pits one man, the chief priest of the deity Ulu, against the colonial administrators, Christian missionaries, and ultimately his own people. Arrow of God is set in rural Nigeria during the 1920s in a southern part of the country where the Igbo people reside. The novel begins with a war between two neighboring regions of rural Igbo land. Bear with me here, I am dyslexic, this is not my first, second, or third language. I am going to make some mistakes, and I apologize in advance. It's not because I didn't try, I did. Umuaro, so that's spelled U-M-U-A-R-O, and Okpe. Perry, which is spelled like okay, Perry, like Perry Perry chicken.
Okay.
So Umuaro is made up of six villages. These six villages are linked by the worship of the common god Ulu, of which Ezeulu is our main priest guy. The god Ulu is also very much tied with harvest. If it becomes a problem, you'll see why very quickly.
That's going to be a problem for the yams.
It's going to be a problem for the yams. Yeah. Yam.
Yam.
That's right.
Jesus Christ. Okay. Sweet. Potato. Yeah. Let's go.
So the people of Umuaro, which is probably how I'm going to end up pronouncing it the entire time because that's how my brain sees it, even though I have tried multiple times to pronounce it the correct way, or what I assume is the correct way, started war with Okeperi over a land they want to claim because there's infighting, you know, between places anyways. And that's okay. It's just bad when the British start also being around.
Yeah, because the British come in and they just like take advantage of all those schisms.
Correct. So they're encouraged to start this war by a wealthy man named Nakwa, who challenges Ulu. This war is launched against the advice of Ulu's chief priest, Ezeulu, like we talked about. So Ezeulu is like, y'all don't do this war. It's not worth it. Like, bad things are going to happen. I know what's going to happen. I don't lie. Don't do this war. I'm telling you not to do this war. It's basically like nobody listens to Ezeulu.
Nobody listens to Ezeulu.
But they still go anyways, and they still do the war, and then the colonial administration, #British, step in to stop the war and rules in favor of Okeperi after discussing the matter with Ezeulu. So basically, the British talk to Ezeulu. Ezeulu's like, you know what? Yeah, we picked a fight. That's our bad. And the colonial people are like, bad. Bad Umuaro. So Captain Winterbottom, which, yes, as stupid as a name as you want it to be.
Dumbass name.
Breaks and burns all the guns in Umuaro, which is going to have effects.
Can you burn guns? That doesn't sound safe.
Well, you can. Like, you can't burn the metal, but you can burn the wood parts.
You'd have to, like, make sure that there's no gunpowder in them because you'd freaking explode the village.
Well, you're gonna melt them down anyways for scrap, right? So, like, do it far away from people and it's probably fine.
Jesus. All right. So we've disarmed an entire village of people.
That we had armed because white people. Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Yep.
So, understandably, the people of Umuaro who, like, worship Ezeulu because they worship Ulu, you know, get mad with him because he didn't take their side. I would also be mad if, like, my one guy decided to not take my side, even though I was wrong. You know, like, I was gonna say bros before hoes, but that seemed a little condescending considering how fucking patriarchal this book is. At some point in the book, they talk about a woman. When I was vaguely skimming it earlier, I was brought back to my notes. And in the book, at some point, they talk about a woman's uncleanliness, which is basically just her being on her period. And I'm so fucking fed up with this patriarchal society that just keeps getting aggravated by the fact that the British are there.
Gotcha.
So anyways, 5 years later, because we have a time skip, which is kind of fun, Christian missionaries have made major inroads into the society, as they do, establishing converts and trying to show that the, like, old gods are basically, like, not useful, right? And that really comes to a head here in this book. So Ezeulu sends his son Odush.
Unfortunate.
It's probably Oduche.
Let's go out on a limb and say we'll say it like that anyway.
He sends his son Oduche to church to be his eyes and ears and to learn the ways of the white man. Now, a sidebar here, Ezeulu has a lot of children because he also has multiple wives, a bit like the characters in your book. That's kind of a common way of existing in this series, which is, you know, to each their own. So he's basically like training one of his sons to be his next priest guy.
His heir.
Sure. And there's like schisms between the sons and like preferential treatment, and it's a bad time. And one of his sons accuses Ezeulu of sending Oduche to like church so that he couldn't become the priest. And Azulu's like, well, I think that the Christian missionaries are a bad thing, and sometimes you need to sacrifice people to bad things. So basically, he sends his son there to like be his eyes and ears, but he also like sacrifices him for that as well, because like he's never gonna be like not a colonized person, I guess, afterwards. So there's a lot of like time there. So animosity begins between Ezeulu and Nakwa, who's like one of the guys who wanted the war earlier, and their respective villages. And we're now at the point where the two villages are trying to kill each other with poison.
Ooh.
Yeah. So Nakwa is fortified and strengthened by his relationship with, I'm going to mispronounce this, is Idemili?
Okay.
That's the high priest of the god Idemili. So basically the Ezeulu of the other god. So Idemili is a lesser god in comparison to Ulu, and the competition between the two priests is dividing Umuaro and basically like just starting to like really break down the community that they have.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. So to make matters worse, the competition isn't limited to within the Igbo religion. mission. So the missionaries call the Christian Igbo, including Oduche, to kill a sacred python. I think it's the sacred python, but nonetheless.
Hey, my book had a killing of the sacred python too.
Yeah, that is seems to be like a recurring theme.
That's like the thing to do. Yeah. Every 30 years, we kill a sacred python.
Oh, see here, they don't kill the python.
Oh.
Not allowed.
Oh, geez, all right.
Yeah, so the missionaries are like, kill the python. And people are like, we don't kill the python here. So Oduche chickens out at the last minute, thankfully, and puts the snake in a box instead. But his family discovers the snake while he's at church. Doing anything to the royal python is considered an abomination. We don't touch the royal python. So because the python also belongs to this other god, Idemili, that creates like further ripples throughout the community. And that priest sends a messenger to Chai to Zulu and to basically ask, like, how are you gonna like fix your house? Because now it's filled with all of these like bad things, right? And Zulu's basically like, you know what? Go die.
Oh, jeez, all right.
Which I think is funny. Zulu is a bit of a, he's not like a funny haha character, but... He's a little funny. So colonialists are going to colonialize, and they've decided to build a road between Okaperi and Umaru. So they've run out of funds because colonialism.
They're doing colonialism, but they're also poor bad at it.
Yeah. So the overseer of this like thing decides that he wants to do conscripted labor. We call that slavery.
Yikes.
Yeah, so he receives permission to do this. And Umaru, the village of Umaru, is the village that is chosen to do the unpaid labor. So one day, Azulu's son, he has many, as we've talked before, Obika, is late getting to work because he had like too much palm wine and he's like drunk. And he gets like very cocky and he kind of like talks back to the overseer or whatever and gets whipped.
No.
Yeah. And that stirs up a lot of resentment from the people doing the unpaid labor.
Obviously.
Who are like, why the fuck are we being asked to work for free when the other village gets paid for their labor? They kind of like bitch about it, but they never do anything about it. So that kind of like demonstrate to the reader that things are unfair, but there doesn't seem to be like any way to do anything significant about it at the moment, you know?
I don't like that.
Yeah, but Azulu's not like the most rational human being in the world. So he thinks that Obika probably has done something to deserve the whipping, and like that creates like a whole kerfuffle in his house. Understandably, because Azulu is being unreasonable.
Yeah.
So Edogo, who's the eldest son, is the one who like has the idea that, hey, maybe having a favorite's a problem. So he's like the one who puts the pin on like, hey, our dad's trying to like influence the god on who's gonna be like the next priest. And that's when Azulu sent Oduche to like go become a church guy, but he's also been training Nawafo in the ways of the priesthood, so like clearly he's trying to make Nawafo the one who becomes the next priest. And then Edogo's like, what if he doesn't choose Nawafo? What if he chooses someone else, and how will that divide the family? And because he's the eldest, he's gonna have to deal with it. So then Odogo, the eldest son, goes to one of Azulu's friends and is like, please, for the love of God, talk to my dad because he's unhinged. For the love of Ulu, talk to my dad because he's unhinged. So this friend, Akuebue. I am trying.
Akuebue?
Akuebe, thank you. I'm... Being dyslexic is very hard. especially because I have the dyslexia that's worse when I'm speaking out loud.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I apologize. I sincerely apologize to all the Igbo people and Nigerians writ large for how I am butchering the name of every single character in this novel and also every place. Akwebe is what we had decided on, right?
Akwebwe, I think, based on how you were saying it.
Okay, that makes sense. So he finds that Azulu's not receptive to talk about the divisions within Umaru, blaming the people of Umaru for the white man's arrival. The people of Umaru try to blame Azulu because he told the white man the truth when Winterbottom stepped in to stop the war between the two villages. Azulu is also unreceptive to reports of division within his own household. He admits that he sacrifices Odush.
Hang on.
Yeah.
Akwebwe's first name is Ogwefi?
Maybe.
That was a character in my book.
That's possible. It's possible that they have like some... I could not find a source that would tell me which characters were in both books.
Okay, no. They're not the same person. Ogwefi Yazudu is the oldest man in the village who dies and things fall apart about 20 to 30 years before the events of your book. And Ogwefi is Azulu's best friend.
Yes.
Very, very similar sets of names there. But Yeah. Not the same person. All right. I can see why I was confused.
Okay, cool. This is good. It's good that we're having this conversation. So meanwhile, Captain Winterbottom gets stressed out about the concept of indirect rule. So he needs to find a chief for Umaru. And there's this whole like dialogues system in the book about like the white man's chief and how chiefs are popping up like mushrooms. So he decides, obviously, we're going to take the guy who has like the path of least resistance. He's already like a high priest for their main god. We'll make Azulu the chief of Umaru. That makes sense. I mean, like, that actually does kind of make sense. So he sends, like, a messenger to, like, fetch Azulu, being like, bring me the priest. And Azulu's like, no, I don't leave my hut, my god of Ulu hut. I do not leave it.
Relatable.
I also don't like to leave my hut. My hut is my home. So he tells the messenger, like, go back to Winterbottom. And if, like, he wants me there, he'll come visit me. Like, you come to me. So Winterbottom is like, fuck that noise. Arrest him. And sends two cops to fetch him. Maybe we shouldn't call the cops.
Don't talk to the cops.
Say no to cops. So the next day, after consulting with the elders and the men of Tidal and Umaru, Azulu's like, fine, I'll go see what Winterbottom wants. His heart's angry because Umaru continues to blame him for the white man's presence and because they don't show proper respect for Ulu. His arch enemy, Nakwa, the rich guy from the beginning, continues to challenge Ulu, the god, and people don't seem to do anything about it. So the two cops are dumb.
What else is new?
And pass Azulu on the way to Azulu's hut. Don't realize it's him, so Azulu just keeps walking. Then Winterbottom gets violently ill, probably malaria, based on like the symptoms that they talk about. And the African servants decide that Azulu must have a lot of power because he's only sick after issuing the warrant for Azulu's arrest. So when Azulu arrives, all the servants are like afraid, right? They're like, oh, not good. They don't want to lock him up as it's ordered to do. Instead, they pretend that the guard room is the guest room and try to make him comfortable.
Oh my god.
So in his first night there, Azulu has a vision and realizes that his real battle is with his own people, not the white men at all. In his vision, he sees Nakwa challenge Ulu and the people spitting on Azulu, saying that he is the priest of a dead god. He begins to see that the white man has been able to take advantage of Umaru's division to sow further seeds of destruction, and he hopes that Winterbottom detains him for a long time so he can better plan his revenge. So basically, Azulu seems to be like starting to get resentful of his people and trying to find a way to keep them in line. But I think he's going about it the entirely wrong way.
The thing is that there's always going to be conflict in any place.
White people don't help.
White people never help. But any discussion of colonialism where it's like, oh yes, this was such a peaceful place before the white people came and then made the war, is kind of like paternalistic.
It's infantilizing also.
Yeah, it's exactly infantilizing of like distinct cultures that obviously had conflict with each other.
Yeah, like I think we see that rhetoric often with like the indigenous people here.
Yeah, like there were conflicts between indigenous nations before white people got here. White people just capitalized on that and made it a million times worse.
And that's a big thing, like when people are like, oh well, like colonialism wasn't that bad, they were already fighting with each other. And it's like, yeah, and then we came over with all of our guns and made it worse.
Like they can both be true. There could have been conflict because
they were full-ass communities, nations.
The nature of humanity is that there is conflict between different groups of people and different people within groups.
Yeah.
And then also colonialism is really bad.
Like, one of the main things we try to, like, find in archaeological digs is weapons because we know that they are prolific through every culture.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, for hunting, for against each other, like, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, it's one of the first things we find. So.
Anyway, sorry, that was a sidebar.
No, it's a good sidebar to have. Azulu's detained for a couple months, and this guy, Mr. Clark, who's also just like a bitchy ass white guy, decides to teach him a lesson and make him wait longer. And then he offers Azulu the position of chief, but Azulu refuses. Angry, Clark keeps him in prison, and Winterbottom's like, yeah, go Clark, saying that he should keep Azulu locked up until he learns his lesson to cooperate. But then, like, because Clark apparently has a conscience, he decides that, like, he doesn't have a legitimate reason to keep Azulu in prison, and then they, like, send them out, right? Like, he's like, fine, set you free. Go do your thing. So Azulu returns home. Here's an interesting thing about Azulu and Ulu as a god. So Ulu is also like the god that kind of dictates the year. And they keep track of the year, I believe it's like on a lunar cycle, by the priest of Ulu, Azulu in this case, eating a yam for every new moon, basically. So every like month he eats a yam. He has to eat 13 for the year to have passed.
Okay.
So that's kind of like one of the main roles of Azulu, is to keep track of time. And we were having a conversation about if people in my class, if people respect and like want Azulu in their lives and all that kind of stuff. And I don't have the exact notes for this because I had written it all down and of course I lost my note. But I'm sitting there in class, you know, Chantal, you know me sitting there in class.
Oh, I'm familiar. Classic Amy sitting in class.
With my hand on the back of the chair thinking like a pompous asshole because I was. With my colleagues in my class telling me, like my peers being like, oh, they really respected him, blah, 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 talking about how he's a god and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, they used him as a calendar. And Pius lost it. He was like lounging in his chair. He sat up, clapped his hands, go off. And I think that's still the peak of my academic career.
Oh my god, I love you.
So we had a thing in class. For like the rest of the class, we would put our deadlines in our Azulus. And I, like...
Oh my god.
On a scale of 1 to microaggression, that's probably at least a 3. But Pius thought it was hilarious, so I'm letting it slide. And we still have that inside joke with people from the class. I have the image of Pius laughing etched into my brain.
I love it. I love that.
So that's funny.
You painted a very vivid word picture of it. So I know that you have it.
Yeah. So anyways, Azulu returns home and everybody's glad to see him. And Azulu realized that his anger wasn't directed against his real neighbors, but against the idea that they were mocking Ulu and disrespecting Azulu, right? It's this whole idea of respect that I was talking about. So nevertheless, he lays low and sets his revenge plan in action. So when the time for announcing the Feast of the New Yam comes, so basically
Feast of the New Yam.
The big harvest time, he fails to announce it. His assistants, the people he's training, you know, come and ask if he's forgotten his duties. And he's basically like, fuck off, leave. So next, the elders come in and they're like, hey, Feast of the New Yam? And Azulu's like, I still have 3 sacred yams left to eat. So what happens is that they collect all of the yams every year. And then of those yams, Azulu picks 13 as these sacred yams. And he eats one for every month of the year to tell us when this happens.
Sure.
So he was unable to eat the sacred yams while in prison in Okeperi. So in the jail. So now he has to follow the rules, which is 1 yam a month.
Oh my god, he's malicious compliancing them.
He's malicious compliancing them.
Oh, dude.
So the men are horrified. They're like, if we wait 3 months before you being able to harvest our crops, like our crops will be ruined and we'll like suffer from widespread famine. Because like they can harvest the yams that are like around their house, but they can't do any of like the big, like they can only harvest enough to eat around their house, not the big, big harvests. So they're like, buddy, if we don't harvest enough for the entire year because our crops have like rotted in the soil, we're gonna be shit out of luck. And Azulu's like, I didn't eat all the yams yet, so can't.
Oh, no.
So the elders are like, bro, just eat the yams. Like, if there's anything wrong, we'll just like tell Ulu that like it should fall on us and not on you, because you know there's all these like lesser gods or whatever. Azulu's like, that's not how that works. Like, whatever your intentions are, as chief priest, it's gonna be me who's gonna suffer the consequences of breaking the rules, so I can't do it. So there's a Christian like Bible guy called Mr. Good Country, which... wide eyes.
That was a good face. That was a really good face.
He sees this as an opportunity. He says that if anybody wants to offer their yams to the Christian God instead, they can harvest their yams and they'll receive protection of the Christian God as well.
I gotcha.
So as people begin to suffer, they turn to the capital G God. So meanwhile, Obika, one of Azula's son, is sick and is asked to help in the funeral preparations for one of the elders of the village who has died some months back. He helps with the funeral rituals by carrying the mask of the night spirit and chases after day. It's like a whole ritual that they have. It's really cool. He runs so hard and fast though that he drops dead when he returns home.
What the hell? You know what? TBH, kind of how I felt after running the 5K in school.
It's kind of how I felt after running for the bus. So the people say it's a judgment against Azulu and that like Ulu, his god, has spoken. Azulu's too stubborn, too proud, and the god has decided to side with its people, not with his priest. But you know, it was a bad time to humiliate Azulu, and it allowed people to take liberties. That year, many of the yams were harvested in the name of the Christian god, and the crops reaped afterwards were also reaped after the Christian god. So as Arrow of God comes to a close, it seems that the worship of the Christian god has replaced that of Ulu. Azulu finishes his life as an old priest, kind of kooky, kind of out of it, in his hut, and kind of remains unaware of everything that's kind of gone wrong. So that's partially Arrow of God. I think I've left enough in there that if you really want to read it, you still have a lot to learn and to gather from it. And I really wish I had all my notes because I think you really would have appreciated having that kind of background. But I hope that it was an interesting episode. I hope that I made Pius proud enough. I mean, he gave me a good grade overall, so I'm sure my paper was fine. And that's that.
I really like Chinua Achebe.
Yeah.
For lots of reasons. Uh-huh. But one of the reasons I like him so much is because he names the white people the most hilarious stereotype names.
Yeah.
It's giving the way that white writers name their indigenous characters.
Oof.
Where it's like, my name's Jack Smith, and my name's John Goodcountry, and my name is Evan Unconvincing Name, you know? Like,
my name's Mr. White.
My name's Mr. White. Not Mr. White.
My name's Mr. White, and my wife is named Blanche White. Yeah. That's where we're at.
Jonathan Pale. Excellent. Yeah.
Excellent.
No, that was it. I liked your summary. I think that definitely I can see where you were coming from last week when you were saying that there's a lot of
similarities,
themes that carry through.
Yeah.
And also like the plot of the process of colonization carries through the trilogy.
Yeah.
I would be interested to see what the middle book is all about. But the overall concept of this podcast is generally books we read in our undergrad. We did not read that in our undergrad, but we could go back to it.
Well, not just our undergrad. I read this during my master's.
Oh, rad.
Yeah.
But yeah, we could go back. We could totally go back. We've read many books now that are outside the overall premise of the podcast. So let us know if you would like to hear about the second book in the trilogy.
No. If you've read the second book in the trilogy, you come on the podcast.
And you can tell us about it.
That's what Pius would say.
And we'll just sit here.
Pius would say, you do it.
Thanks, Pius.
Yeah.
Still looking out for us.
Yeah, I'm waiting on my grade, though. So on a scale, Chantel.
Go on.
On a scale of 1 to 13 yams.
Yams.
But these are like special harvest yams.
Okay, all right, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Different yams.
Yeah.
How would you rate this?
I would rate this 9 special yams.
Okay.
I think that it sounds like a very interesting, good read. I think that I really like Chinua Achebe's style, and I'd probably be into it again. I think that it sounds like there's more humor thrown into this one than there was into mine.
I think Pius is funny, and this is going into my rating, which is I still have 3 yams left to eat. I think I wouldn't have enjoyed this novel half as much if Pius hadn't been the one to teach it to me.
Aww.
Because of how, like, a champion of Nigerian culture he is. Like, he wrote many books about Nigerian culture. Some of them are satirical. Like, he's just, like, this force to be reckoned with. And, like, when he speaks, you shut up and you listen. And just the way that he would speak about Achebe and the way that he would speak about his country and the way that he would speak about this novel just made you love it. Despite the fact that, like, I actually don't think I love this book that much because I found a lot of the patriarchal aspects a little too frustrating for how much of a feminist I am, kind of thing. Despite the fact that some of that was like ingrained in the culture and some of it was like, you know, British colonialism aggravating problems that were already there, I found that part a little hard to swallow. But nonetheless, if Pius hadn't been there, like, you know, I don't think I would have loved it as much, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, and I'm glad that he was, and I'm glad that I got to meet him.
What a lovely kind of memorial episode.
Yeah, I think it is. Actually, I was with Zach when I learned that he had passed away.
Oh.
Zach was on the couch and I was on the floor. I like being on the floor, don't worry about it. We were taking like a break from being people. I was on the news or something and I saw that there was a crash, and then I quickly learned that Pius was on that plane, and I like stood up from the floor, sat up, and I was like, I just lost one of my professors to the Boeing MAX 8 crash in Ethiopia. And then I lost my mind for a couple days.
I remember.
And then I went to the funeral, which I think was like a huge disassociation period episode for me. Kind of fucked me up again. And I don't think I've ever like truly processed it properly, if that makes sense.
It's just kind of incomprehensible.
And I can't even imagine to like the people who had him as like a thesis supervisor, or anybody who was like closer to him, you know, like how that must feel like his family. And I just, I think part of it is that his soul was on Earth to make a mark, you know? And
yeah,
he fucking made it.
And now we're sharing it with all of you people.
Yeah. So if you want, I can rattle out some of the book titles that he wrote just so you have them around you. So he has written The Wayfarer and Other Poems, which was published in 2001. You're Not a Country, Africa, which was published in 2011. He's gonna hate me for this one. Nija No Day Carry Last, which was published in 2015. It's a collection of satirical essays, which is fun.
That sounds like you said it right.
I think so. I don't think I fucked it up that much.
You just need more confidence.
Probably. I'm dyslexic. It's fine. And then posthumously, Who Owns the Problem? Africa and the Struggles for Agency, which was published in 2020. Yeah. So that's Pius.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for listening. Again, if you want to hear more of Nigerian literature, we got it. So hit us up. Otherwise, we will be jumping into whatever our little brains come up with. We're trying to get ahead on episodes because both of us have a pretty busy spring and summer coming up.
I'm getting married again.
Surprise, Amy's getting married again. Amy was inspired by the polygamy from this book, actually.
Now we're doing a traveling wedding. It's going to be fun.
Oh, like a traveling circus.
Yeah.
Fun. If you want to talk to us, you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at Unsighted Pod. If you like this episode, we would love if you gave us a 5-star rating. It's just in the corner of the app you're listening to. And you can just hit that little 5-star button, and that would be awesome. We are grateful that you were here with us, and we hope to see you in 2 weeks.
And as always, we're excited and available. This is Married Life with Amy. We are running out of garbage bags, so Sam was like, I'll go buy garbage bags. And our garbage has a sticker on it that says 30 liters. It's my garbage. I brought it to the marriage. And he was like, okay, cool, 30 liters. Yeah, that's the outside canister. That makes sense. So he goes and buys 25 liters bags of garbage. And I was like, you bought garbage bags for the smaller garbages around the house? Because we don't have plastic shopping bags anymore, right? So we can't use those. We're like running out.
Same.
Which is like an inconvenience, but good planet. Woo.
Is it though?
Yeah, I have thoughts.
No, it's not.
It's not. Because now I have to buy garbage bags for them, which I didn't have to buy garbage bags for them before. They were serving more than one purpose before.
Yeah. And now the reusable bags are like 5 times as polluting as the plastic bags. Doesn't matter. Anyway.
Doesn't matter. Anyways, so he was like, no, I bought it for the big canister. And I was like, those are too small for the big canister. And he's like, no, they're not. They're 25 liters. I'm like, yeah, garbage is 30. He's like, yeah, but not the inside canister. And I was like, yes, the inside canister.
What else would it be?
And he was like, oh, well, I'll check tomorrow. And I was like, okay, cool. He's like, yeah, the bags won't fit. I was like, I know.
Yeah, it was there.
So then I'm having supper by myself because he went to play Magic the Gathering. And I'm eating my like leftover carbonara. And I'm like, fuck, this tastes disgusting. What happened to it? And I'm like, okay, fine. You know, I don't finish it because I'm like, I can't stomach this. So I like try to eat something else, like guacamole. Guacamole also tastes off. What the fuck? Why is it smelling? Like, what's making this taste like this? And I go to brush my teeth. It doesn't help. And then I'm sitting down like to prepare for the podcast at the table where the garbage bags were. And I was like, everything tastes and smells disgusting. I am nauseated. I want to puke. And then I realized the bags are the Febreze bags, which smell decomposing already. So then I put them in a plastic bag that we have leftovers from our shopping days and it put it somewhere else in the house and that didn't work. So now I have put it in a chest that I have in a plastic bag in the box. No. And if that doesn't work, I'm telling Sam to take him outside because like I can't live like this.
You know what you should do?
What?
Open the window, put it outside the window, close the window, and then it'll just be hanging out the window. And in addition to being outside, it will freeze. So the smell will probably dissipate.
Yeah, I was thinking of just like chucking them in the car and asking him to return them.
The car will smell like them.
The car is also outside in minus many degrees.
That's a good point.
So I think it'll be the same thing as your freezing them thing. Anyways, that's been my story for the day. I also don't really feel like a person, so that didn't help because I get a lot of my like, you're alive vibes from like good tasting food and I've had none today.
Girl, like, don't we all? That is such, that's not a neurotypical thing.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
So anyways, that's clean language with Amy. Don't buy the wrong plastic garbage bags and make sure they're not Febreze. I don't know. I just want them out of my house. It's all I feel right now. So tell me how neurotypical I am again.